It's November the 20th, 2012. I'm Peter Lim, Africana bibliographer and adjunct associate professor of history here at Michigan State University, and I'm joined by Professor of Sociology, David Wiley, and Professor of Education and African Studies Center Outreach Coordinator, John Metzler, for this, the latest of the African Studies interview series with conversations with prominent African Studies scholars associated with MSU. Dave, you and I started this series, and you joined us to interview John Hunter in the inaugural episode back in 2003, and again for the latest interview with David Robinson just a few weeks ago. So it's delightful to have you back on the other side of the interviewing table. Welcome.
Thank you.
David Wiley has a long and distinguished career at Michigan State University in sociology and especially in African studies. He's professor of sociology and African studies at MSU. His research has focused on, inter alia, Zambia, on housing, religion and class, Zimbabwe, race relations, religious movements, Kenya, on development of fisheries, South Africa, and environment and social movements, as well as international studies and African languages in the US, and currently on the dilemmas of militarization in Africa. He served as director of the African Studies Center here at MSU for 31 years, from 1978 to 2008, and also at the University of Wisconsin-Madison from 1972 to 77. His graduate degrees are from Yale and Princeton. His most recent book is International and Language Education for a Global Future, 50 Years of the U.S. Title VI and Fulbright-Hays Programs, a co-edited volume from, very appropriately, MSU Press in 2010. His most recent article, I think, is on the militarization of Africa, published in the African Studies Review, Journal of the African Studies Association, a body to which he has devoted much care and of which he was president. He has also been chair of the Committee on International Sociology of the American Sociological Association, vice chair of the U.S. National Commission for UNESCO, and co-chair and co-founder of the Council of National Title VI Resource Centers and of the Association of Concerned African Scholars, who awarded him the Bud Day Award for African Activism in 2009. He chaired the International Committee of the National Science Foundation and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Among his many other achievements, he co-founded at MSU the Center for Advanced Study of International Development, Women and International Development Program, the African E-Journals Project, the African Media Program, the Program on the Lakes of East Africa, and the National Consortium for the Study in Africa. And in the 1960s through the 1990s, Professor Wiley participated very actively in the movement for decolonization in Africa, especially Southern Africa, and the anti-apartheid movement, both nationally and at MSU.
Wow. Quite impressive, Dave. I thought we should start early, way before MSU, and start in Harrisburg, Illinois, and I've known you for 25 years now, and you've often spoken about that formative period of your life, and so maybe reflect a little bit on how that experience may have prepared you for your future in Africa.
Well, thank you for that question, and thank you to both of you for doing this. It's wonderful to do an interview like this with colleagues that you respect so much for their work and their commitments and who have added so much to the African programs at Michigan State. So, at any rate, well, I was born in Harrisburg, Illinois. I went to grade school and high school there. It was really on the fringes of Appalachia, and my experience was very much that of Appalachia at the end of the Great Depression when I was born, at the end of the Dust Bowl in the U.S., in F.D. Roosevelt's regimes, and the living through as a child in the Good War in World War II, and all that meant for the patriotism and the republicanism that in my family that we imbibed on, but it was, it was an experience that it prepared me for Africa, because the folks next door kept chickens in the backyard, or always eating our garden plants when they came up. They butchered a hog that they kept in the backyard every fall to get some lye and make soap for the winter. It was really the bottom of the lower class of Appalachian America, and very few in my high school class went to college at all, and we had a big argument in my family about whether or not I should join my father, who had worked his way up out of repairing cars to actually opening a automobile dealership for Lincolns and Mercurys in the 1950s in the post-war World War II boom, and whether or not I should stay there as for Wiley and Sons, or whether I should go to college. After much argument, they finally concurred to let me go, and of course I didn't know where to go. There's little knowledge of higher education institutions there, so I ended up at Wabash College in Indiana, where I put myself through as a meal planner and supervisor at a local fraternity, working nights, doing body work, which I'd learned in Harrisburg at my dad's shop, in the local Lincoln Mercury dealer, to get enough money to get me through this private college there. But I think that experiencing poverty, cutting timber manually with a mule team and hauling it out to the sawmills, which for lumber became we used to make my folks home in the end, learning concrete finishing and bricklaying skills, pumping gas, greasing cars, all of that really gave me a kind of an orientation toward an appreciation of laboring people who use their hands to make their life. And the experience of rural Appalachia there really was very similar to what I found in Africa when I finally end up there. The other thing that I'm struck by in all that, you know, as I think now, as I was looking at what 3 terabyte hard drive to order this week to store my computer documents, I was thinking back to my purchase in 1958 of a manual typewriter, the only kind that existed at that time, to take to the Soviet Union on a youth exchange that I went on from Yale. But so the technological change of our era has just been astonishing, as well as the transformation of the U.S. from, you know, the good country that jumped in and helped Europe fight against the Axis powers and the Japanese during World War II, to the post-war years when we were the good guys and helped push to found the United Nations, UNESCO, all the UN family of organizations for a better world, and then went to Africa in the 60s with a commitment to build a new development phase in these independent nations in the 1960s, and then falling into the Cold War and the following many years of great harm to Africa and the collapse of economies there. So I sort of feel like the historical period has been very turbulent and quite varied that we've lived through, and sometimes have trouble putting all those pieces together as tempus fugit. Time flies so quickly.
You went to Wabash as a pre-med student, I believe. But then how did that transition from pre-med into seminary work at Princeton at Yale Divinity School?
Well, that was a hard story. It was very good zoology and chemistry, and I got admitted to the University of Illinois and Washington U. St. Louis Medical Schools. But we had a pre-med group at the college, and I found that my colleagues were, frankly, to put it bluntly, racist, sexist, materialist, not a pleasant group to be among. And so my roommate, a philosophy major, threw into his wastebasket a form for the Rockefeller Fund to try a year of seminary education, and which fascinated me because you could go to the seminary of your choice. And I was interested in the work of Richard Niebuhr at Yale Divinity School and his focus on ethics. And so I filled this out, and to my surprise, got an award, ended up for a year at Yale, liked it, focused on higher education, where the attention there was kind of history of the university and how universities can be an independent force for criticism and support of nations and peoples and their development. So I liked that. Put off my medical school, and then one thing led to another. End up taking an internship at University of Delaware, where I was the acting Presbyterian University pastor there for a year. In with a house in the black community there in what was really a mid-South experience. And about out of that fell into becoming the campaign organizer for the first black city councilman in Delaware, and which led to the Presbyterian Church calling me up one day and say, well, you seem to be interested in race relations. How about an internship in for a couple of years in Africa in that field? And that's what got me off to Africa. At the same time, by the way, that finding I was married, I could not go to Senegal, which is where they originally thought I should go to work in the Centre de Bop, but found this other young seminarian to take my place named David Robinson, who then has another history here that we've already interviewed. So I think that that's, I think the University of Delaware, studying the university and what where the university stands in the world as a una, something to unite knowledge and perspective and so on, diversity. And then finding in a series of experiences how American universities, in fact, were not so broad and in fact ended up being quite nationalistic. So I fell into great conflict with the president at University of Delaware for inviting the Czech ambassador to come up from Washington to talk to our students, which was unheard of in the Cold War, and I naively thought it was possible. He called out the state police to keep him off campus.
You didn't know about détente.
So
when did you actually go to Southern Rhodesia? What year?
I went to Southern Rhodesia in 1961.
It's very early, of course, and last year I went to a conference at Illinois on Terence Ranger, historian of Zimbabwe, and when I was looking in his papers, I saw letters to one David Wiley in Salisbury, which is now Harare. And, so how did you find it, the educational scene, the religious scene, race relations there?
Well, there was this very creative woman named Margaret Floria, the mission agency in the Presbyterian Church in New York, who was very ecumenical, linked to the World Council and National Council of Churches and other Protestant churches. And she had this vision, it was time to end traditional sending of missionaries to out there, and that we should instead send young people to live on frontiers, which is the frontiers were urban explosion, race relations, economic development, etc., and in my case, race relations. And that they should then live on a subsistence salary. So I think I had $2,000 a year of salary to live on, which meant standing in the bus lines with Africans in the rain and no cars and living in a small African house and
where,
the like.
Where did you live in Salisbury?
In Salisbury, right.
Where? What?
In a white area in on Emerald Hill near the university.
Okay.
Which was the African servants' house of some university lecturers that we...
So near Mount Pleasant, then.
Yes, right. It was in that area. Mm-hmm. And so that she sent out all sorts of people, Gail Moreland Hovey, who became the editor of Southern Africa Magazine for many years, Tammy Kramer, Reed Holtman, who went to South Africa, and then with Bill Mentor founded Africa News, and then allafrica.com in its present and currently Africa Focus, and other young people who were involved in the founding of the North American Congress on Latin America, the Middle East Research and Information Project, etc. A lot of the anti-Peace Corps group that sat in over Vietnam War, the Peace Corps offices in Washington. So a whole group of kind of progressive young people who then got embedded in Africa and other parts of the world. And brought home that experience in the 60s and 70s.
And you made, obviously, lots of African friends. Who were some of these Africans that you befriended in Salisbury?
Well, there was a large number. I mean, first of all, we led work camps to get black and white students who'd never lived together together in the same house in an African township building housing. And so the people like historian on the white side, Keith Rennie, and Margaret Yates, and on the African side, George Nari, Titus Lovu, Titus Dube, and in the end, at a higher level, Nathan Shamirera, And even Mugabe, for to whom I, my wife and I carried messages from Dominique Sotoli, who was in exile in Dar es Salaam at that time, to Mugabe, who was living in Highfields at that time, where I was teaching night school, teaching GCE O-level courses for an African township there, which gave us access. So that was, and then Sharmirira and I ended up in Lusaka after it was declared a PI, and he was editing the Central African Mail there. And then by irony, we both end up at Princeton at Woodrow Wilson School.
That's a prohibited immigrant PI.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Prohibited immigrant, right.
Tell us the story.
I mean, it's fascinating for the listeners. You were declared persona non grata. Why? Because of your friendships.
Well, it was the circles we were running in. There was a group called Christian Action, which was the center of demonstrations against the Law and Order Maintenance Act amendments in what was then Salisbury in the 62-63 period. And so we had this one fun demonstration where at the opening of Parliament, the Prime Minister at that time, Winston Field, comes to the Parliament in his Rolls Royce. The army and the police and the band are all there. And he steps out of the car, and that's the signal for the national anthem to be played. That was the moment we all raised our signs to protest the amendments there, and they all have to stand at attention. The police couldn't come run after us in that case. So we had 5 minutes of demonstration.
This was before UDI. So what was the national anthem? What did Southern Rhodesia have in that, or was it?
It was the Southern Rhodesia national anthem, and I don't even remember it now.
Okay, so they had one. Okay,
so I think they changed it at Rhodesia.
It wasn't God Save
in 65.
Gracious Queen then.
No, it certainly wasn't. Even then, they were more independent than that. And then there were other demonstrations that we did, and I was in charge of taking the movement's messages about the crimes of the Law and Order Maintenance Act Amendment, which required the judge to hang anyone convicted if they'd thrown a petrol bottle at anything, and regardless if anyone was hurt or not, and to be hung, including pregnant women. I mean, so it was a very rapacious law. My job was to get news of this to The Guardian, The Observer, The Times in London as part of the information campaign. And then the other thing we were doing was printing leaflets and posters, and I was in charge of doing that since I knew the Gestetner mimeograph technology. And with some scary case, in one case, having to hide the mimeograph masters in the birdbath in the garden of our landlords because the police were coming. And another case, one of our landlords were hosting members of a sports car club in their living room and came up to tell me that you might be interested. There are three members of the CID are in our sports club, and you have five posters hanging out here on the line to dry in the sun. So we urge you to do something about that. So anyway, the net of all that is, even though we were, by the way, actively supported by Bishop Ralph Dodge, a Methodist bishop in Salisbury at that time, the British Methodist superintendent discovered some things about us, and we were convinced, turned us in. And out of that, we were then declared prohibited immigrants. And it was the same time that they were deporting Terence Ranger, Axel Sommerfeld, Jaap van Velsen, Clyde Mitchell, a whole famous group of Manchester scholars that were in Salisbury.
And some of you ended up in Lusaka.
Yes, that's right. Van Velsen did, Ronald Frankenberg, and others
stayed in Lusaka, or you went back to Princeton?
Went back to Princeton. I actually wanted to go to Yale to the sociology department to continue studies of Africa, because there was more known about Africa at Yale than at Princeton. The Yale acceptance never arrived until they called me in October after I was ensconced at Princeton, which had taken me in, and said, "Where are you?" And I said, "Well, your letter never arrived." So by chance, I ended up at Princeton, where I did sociology at the university and social ethics and at the seminary.
Could we just go back one very briefly to Southern Rhodesia? Because in addition to your social and political activity, this was your first getting your feet first wet in research. Didn't you do some research with an indigenous religious?
Right. I had hoped to do a master's degree sort of jointly with Terence Ranger, who was looking at independent religious movements, and but in social anthropology, which is what I wanted the degree to be in. So it was Clyde Mitchell, who'd written the Kalela Dance and other famous pieces on Central Africa. So I did. Went out and visited, stayed with some of these religious movements, Rupa Nisarwa Jesu, the Johanni Marangi, Johanni Masoi, St. Francis Mission in Rusafi, and most interestingly, the Gutara Jehovah, City of God movement of Amai Chaza in Zimunya Reserve south of Mutare. So I stayed with those, and those were very, very interesting experiences. And out of that, I ended up continuing my dissertation research when I came back to Zambia in 67 on religious organizations, religious movements, both official churches, Catholic, Protestant, and so on, Jehovah's Witnesses, and the independent movements. But I wasn't able to finish that work before the PI ship came along, and so I still look at that material in the box on my shelf and say, wish that I should do something with it one of these days.
But your work in Zambia was also urban sociology. In addition to how did the religious ask the
well, there are two stages
African
of that.
Independent churches
and the first work on the dissertation was a classical Max Weber study of the relationship between class and religion, and Weber said that people end up in the churches that they do based upon their social class position. So not by accident. Highest classes in Britain and the U.S. are Anglican, Episcopalian. Under them are the Presbyterians, and under them are the United Church congregations. Under them are the Methodist and the Baptist, and down lower are the lower classes are the Jehovah's Witnesses, and below them various syncretist movements. And the Catholics up and down, being parallel up and down with some of them upper class. And I found that even in Lusaka. So out in Matero, this township where I worked, there was a big Catholic church which had a Chinyanja service at 8 in the morning, a Chibimba service at 10 in the morning, to which people walked from the township and so on. And in the evening, those people with cars came to the English service. And once again, reflecting that that class stratification of religion, which is exactly like it is in the U.S. and is in urban Zambia. So, yes, that was what the post. Later, after I went to Wisconsin, I came back to Zambia in 73, with seven sociology graduate students from Madison to do this study of Zambia housing study. For the Ministry of Housing and Local Government as a preparatory study for their getting a World Bank loan for providing piped water and sewers and in Zambian townships in Lusaka, Kitwian, and Ndola, all in that a big, so we have this big 3,000 household study which the students got dissertations out of. And which, ironically, because the Zambians, as you probably know, John, having lived there, had this fixation upon the need to present Zambia as a place where people live decently, and they live in decenti housing, as they call, and they plant trees to hide the houses, and so on. So at the end, they knew that we had a lot of information about squatter townships all over Zambia, and were very embarrassed, and announced to me as I was about to come back that you cannot publish anything out of this yourself, or else you will be declared a persona non grata in Zambia forever. I said, that was not our agreement. I raised the money for you to do this study so that you could get the money. I know, but we just do not want.
So this was from the Ministry of Housing then?
Ministry of Housing and Local Government, right.
And this is of independent Zambia.
Independent, yeah.
Right.
And so were you there at independence?
No. I had been there before independence and had taken a trip. I led a work camp in Sofula in Barotseland in 1962, which had famous people like Malau Nkumbula, the daughter of Harry Nkumbula, Sakai Holland, Sakai Hove Holland. They were all young high school students and so on. So we had a great time. And in that process, I went out to the township of Chilinji and wanted to see the house where this famous politician then campaigning for independence and election in 1962, prior to the 64 mm-hmm. independence. Yeah. And there, the guards came out and said, "What are you doing here?" And then when I said it, they took me in and I met Kenneth Kaunda and and Kapwepwe, his Simon vice Kapwepwe, president, yeah. there is yeah. his associate mm-hmm. there. So we had that, but I was not there at independence. I'd gone back to, and was at starting graduate study with a new young son at Princeton at that point.
What did you feel when you went back to that independent Zambia? Because it was, as with Zimbabwe later on, you were going back to countries that at one stage you'd been there when they were laboring under the yoke of colonialism, and then you go back. Mm-hmm. So you remember your feelings, your thoughts when you went back to an independent Zambia? Or were you straight into the post-colonial problems of housing and whatnot?
Yes and no. I think I suspect John shares my feelings. In those early years in Zambia, it was a very optimistic period. Yes, yes. It was one Zambia, one nation, or as some wag said, one Zambia, one pint. there was a good spirit. Zambia still has not had the ethnic conflict that we've seen mobilized in lots of other places in Africa. And it's, you know, the big thing I would say about Zimbabwe and Zambia, both in the repressive colonial period and afterwards, was the spirit and the openness of the African people. And I think that probably that's the experience of all three of us, that we're captured by the African spirit of hospitality, of openness, mm-hmm. of friendship, of networking. And frankly, I saw a level of acceptance, a level of inclusion, a level of respect that I'd never seen in the States in my time. And I think that was why I decided to go back and do graduate study on, because I just wanted to stay with this continent. But we were beginning to see in those 1970s periods the problems of the continent. And I think the other thing that was emerging was, you know, once again, in the early 60s, a very great optimistic period. Even I remember watching, Kennedy name Governor G. Menin Williams of Michigan as his first Assistant Secretary of State for Africa as a reward for tipping Michigan in Kennedy's very close mm-hmm. election. And G-Men and Soapy Williams, later to become the Chief Justice in Michigan of the Supreme Court, went up and down Africa, you know, Africa for the Africans. We were the first new nation. We threw off the yoke of the British before you did. It was a message that Africa wanted to hear and scared the British and the French and the Belgians and the Portuguese to death, because they saw the U.S. coming to compete with them for their neo-colonial markets and the like. And so I even remember I saw Soapy Williams land in his Dakota DC-3 in Harare in Salisbury in 62 and get out, walk right past the Rhodesian tailed and top-hatted officials from government to the fence where the Africans were lined up behind it, kept out, and went down in typical American good political fashion, shaking hands and symbolizing that the future lay with Africa. So it was a great, exciting period. Only recently have I discovered what was a very slowly dawning consciousness in my own mind, that there was another side of the story. And that while there were these wonderful U.S. Information Agency grants, there was strong support from the State Department for Independent Africa, there was USAID talking about development, providing grants for food security and environment, and later on for HIV, that where all that was on one track, on the other track was the schizophrenic mode of deep intelligence and military hostility to anything that looked slightly left-leaning. And later on, I've recently seen some documents they're releasing about from the White House and the State Department now, and the U.S. security apparatus was going crazy about Soapy Williams' utterances in Africa and so on. And the symbol of most of all of what that came to was when a young agricultural engineer, Agostino Netu, later become the first president of Angola, comes to Washington to meet with this man who's talking about Africa for the Africans. I mean, this is the early 60s. The Portuguese weren't going to collapse for another 13 years. When we then start this civil war in Angola. And State Department quickly kept NATO from coming into the State Department. I think there was a private meeting with Sophie Williams in Georgetown. Mm-hmm. But the word was, we're with the Portuguese. And as we watched Nixon selling 707 airplanes to the Portuguese military to ferry their troops to the wars in Angola and Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, as we saw the U.S. military providing herbicides, as has been used in Vietnam, to use against village populations, food crops that sided with FNLA, UNITA at that time, or MPLA in Angola, and the whole provision of weapons and support, that suddenly it was dawning on us, you know, that there was another side to this story. I'd seen that, you know, following on the Czech ambassador incident at University of Delaware, I'd seen this at Princeton, where I remember watching John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State, Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, and John Engelhard, the model for Goldfinger in the movies, and a rapacious U.S. Minerals dealer who was deeply attached to South Africa, walking literally arm in arm at the annual alumni parade. And I saw other aspects of it there. And then we go to Wisconsin, and we had all the upheaval in the late 60s and early 70s around Vietnam, and the blowing up of the Army Math Research Center, which was part of the U.S. military's contracts with the university. What was most interesting about that was one person injured in that blowing up was a young white South African
who it turned out.
Was getting training in nuclear energy and nuclear weapon technology from the University of Wisconsin in violation of the United Nations and the U.S. arms embargoes and so on. I also at Wisconsin had these scruffy guys in my collective behavior, riot, and revolution class in sociology one day who had on the dungarees and dirty and so on, old shoes and so on, except they had on shiny black socks. Mm-hmm. And I immediately sniffed that something was not right here. So I asked the two of them if I could speak to them right after class, and they immediately bolted and took off. And some months later, it finally was confirmed back to me that the head of the university had approved a COINTELPRO infiltration as an exercise of my class. As at the same time, the MSU was involved in the police training in Vietnam. And the making of a film on Iran to glorify the Shah at just the time that he was losing his place there. And then as I came to MSU, discovering, you know, that what I hadn't known, that there were actually people who had come from the CIA to the MSU history faculty, and that later on we discovered, you know, there were very deep, several pockets of CIA and pro-Rhodesian and South African white orientations here.
So coming to MSU, then you'd been in Wisconsin at Madison for a number of years, and tell us a little bit about your impressions of MSU. I think it was 77, was it, when you came?
Yes.
And what did you think of the state of African studies when you arrived? Because obviously Madison, Wisconsin, by this time had some big shots in African studies, some big involvement in places like Congo, Jan van Siena and others, and here you are arriving and about to have a momentous impact on African studies. Mm-hmm. What did you think of MSU when you arrived?
Well, one of the attractions of coming to MSU was I felt like it was a more activist and a larger African program than I had at Madison. It was also kind of more coordinated. It was a program at Wisconsin and here it was a center.
Less elitist, perhaps, too?
Well, maybe. I'm not sure about that. I mean, there are populist trends at Wisconsin, but I would say kind of less activism. There was the Madison Area Committee on Southern Africa, which participated at the university there, and which then did lead to the Attorney General saying to the university, that you probably are in violation of our civil rights laws if you invest in discriminatory corporations in South Africa and so on, which led to their divestiture. So there are these other traditions. And it was in, was it Madison, you know, where we actually, Bill Minter and Henry Booker and I published a little pamphlet on Israel and South Africa, which then, once again, was supported by the university. But I was warned by a senior professor of my in my department that I probably, if I wanted to stay at Wisconsin, I probably shouldn't involve myself in anti-Semitic activities, which writing about Israel's links to South Africa was regarded as anti-Semitic. And we were attacked by some B'nai B'rith in Milwaukee at that time for our anti-Semitism. So, you know, there were, once again, it was a contested field that we saw here. At MSU, I really liked Ralph Smuckler, who sadly died last week, the Dean of International Studies at that time, who, though involved in the Vietnam Project, was a very humane person and supported us in whatever we felt was the right thing to do. To the extent I remember, by the way, he called me in one day and says, well, MSU had divested in 1978. 1986, the MSU Foundation, separately incorporated, had not divested. And so he called me and said, what do you think about this? I said, I think it ought to divest. He said, well, they're wanting some expert opinion on it. And he said, I don't really agree with you. I think this is not right. But in the end, he took me anyway, knowing that we differed. And that kind of respect was something I found in Ralph Smuckler that was very appealing. John Hunter had stepped in when the center lost its Title VI grant in the early 1970s. And John had started conversations with the provost about the need to move beyond the African studies we had then, much of which in the mid-70s was the residues of the University of Nigeria and Nsukka project, where more than 200 man and woman years had gone to respond to President Nnamdi Azikiwe's invitation to come and to build the first land-grant university in Africa. And those folks had not been trained in African languages or in African studies in general way. Most of them had not done their dissertations on Africa. They were experts to bring American land-grant university education to Nigeria. And so we were lacking people with the depth that was needed, and Hunter began the conversations with the provost at that time, Lee Winder. And out of that came a decision to invest in a series of positions. And so I arrived to complete those discussions with an agreement. We would go out and seek some African stuff in depth. We would found an outreach program, which John becomes the inheritor of later in the center, and would try to expand that center. So that leads to us inviting David Robinson to join history program, Carol Meyer-Scotton to join the linguistics program, later Grover Hudson, Ethiopianist, to join linguistic program.
Is that when Michael Bratton came as
Michael
well?
Bratton as part of that group, and John Hennett in anthropology, who now, did Ethiopia.
Was Bill Durman, or was he here prior?
Bill was already here as of, I think, 1970 or 71. He'd come from Ann Arbor, where and where Bill had been a member of the SDS, and who was then therefore important in helping to found the Southern Africa Liberation Committee here. But at any rate, in addition to that, there were a series of other faculty who were turning their attention to Africa in a serious way, and so we could build on them. People, especially in the food security program, with like Carl Eicher, Carl Liedholm in economics, John Statz, who ended up spending a whole career in Mali, Eicher, who becomes the doyen of agricultural economics and food security for all of Africa, Eric Crawford and Jim Bingham, who each spent 5 or 6 years in Senegal helping to work on and who master French there, Tom Jane later on, Michael Weber, and I can so. And then by chance, we get this wonderful Ethiopian, Sefa Mretu, who's kicked out of Ethiopia by the Derg in the Soviet period in Ethiopia and becomes the associate director of the center. Eugene Dabinko, who was the Africana librarian here, Anima Ezera, who's picked up to become a second Africana librarian before Joe Lauer and Peter Lim come to grace our presence. So, and then we had some excellent leadership in the sciences, in communications, in the medical schools, as some people were catching fire about focusing on malaria in Africa. And we get this wonderful veterinary physiologist, James Cunningham, who becomes chairman of the center's advisory committee for 13 years and really helps us.
And what was your role in all this? By now you are the director of the African Studies Center?
Well, I was associate director for about the first 9 months.
Right.
Then by fall of 77.
Was John Hunter then still director?
John was director in that time, right. And he from geography, now retired. So I think what was so good is the university had enough margins that they could invest in some substantive Africanists. We then decided to try to professionalize the African language program, and which was we were offering one or two languages. One was Mauritian Creole, I remember, and many people were one, and Chibimba, simply because Professor Richardson happened to be here. It was not very systematically organized, and so we were able to get David Dwyer appointed in the African language linguistics program and in anthropology, and with David build then a language program around what we regard the highest priority. At that time, I think it was 22 or 23 languages of Africa, eventually enlarged to about 30, which we said, we would offer on demand. And then we spent humongous efforts over the years, always trying to find someone who could offer the language of this student wanting to go to Madagascar who needed Malagasy. And there was no Malagasy student speaker on campus, but I think a professional program in which our African language specialists like John Uhlenberg, Grover Hudson, David Dwyer, others supervise the instruction in a language that they didn't necessarily know. But I think it was the key then to building what we're able to turn the corner on by 1982, when we were able to start producing more PhD dissertations on Africa than any other U.S. university after Wisconsin as the second.
Who do you remember then amongst, say, the graduate students? You must have had a good few of them sociology, but on committees from many different African countries and many Americans going off to Africa.
Yeah. There are so many, Peter, that I have trouble coming up with. I mean, people in all sorts of fields, and I was involved in helping the African Student Union start their annual galas and conferences to celebrate Africa on campus at that time. But they were in all sorts of fields. I mean, like Luther Sibisi, who becomes a major figure in the Development Bank in South Africa, now Vetembave Ve, who was my student from Namibia in sociology.
And what a joy to meet them back on African soil.
Well, it is. And some wonderful American students, too. I think particularly in one of my PhD students, Beth Dunford, who mastered Arabic, two versions of Arabic, both Moroccan and Western Saharan, Hassanian Arabic, goes back and does sociology research on women's rights to well-watered lands in the Western Sahara and is a Food for Peace officer, first in Ethiopia, and I think more recently in Iraq, actually. But anyway, brought excellent language skill, and I think that's been the secret to so many of our graduate students' success in the national competitions, which were, to everyone's surprise, I think, that MSU's students were doing as well as they were. The most striking one was the Social Science Research Council International Pre-Dissertation fellowship program, which is providing about $25,000 a year for students to do pre-dissertation work, to sharpen their language in the field, to find their research project, to find collaborators, and so on. And so MSU was excluded from eligibility from that, and they chose, I think it was 19 elite universities, which included University of Michigan and Harvard and Yale and Johns Hopkins and Berkeley and Stanford, et cetera, but not MSU. And so we actually mounted a protest through President DiBiagio that how could they exclude us with a good African program. And turns out you had to have two good programs, so we put Latin America in there, and you had to have good social science, so we had a very complicated process of mounting an expert. We got included. MIT and Illinois gets included with us then, who had been excluded as well. Mm-hmm. Over then, the program then lasts for 10 more years. Even counting in the year that we were excluded from the competition, our students in peer-reviewed competitions nationally won 27% of all the African awards for the nation.
Incredible.
Among those 23 universities. And it just said to everyone, I think, our students may not come in from the elite schools. They may not, you know, come in the highest, but when they get the language, when they get excellent African education, they can compete with the very best and the brightest, and they did. And I think that's been true in the Fulbright programs as well over the years. And that's one thing I think that I'm most proud of all the things that we worked
on. And I think you should be. I mean, yeah. I think when I think of comparing this to other institutions, but also to what the university is now, and this is politically incorrect to say, perhaps, that where graduate education in particular does not have the pride of place within the institution. I think what the center did under your leadership in terms of fostering this, is a real monument to what you did here.
Well, thank you, John. It wasn't supported by a lot of administrators. I mean, there was a president of this institution who did not have a PhD, who, when I told him we had good news, we just shown that once again we were doing more dissertations on Africa than anybody else, so said to me, well, when are you going to do something really relevant? That was not regarded as what was really wanted was money. And ironically, suddenly now MSU from the MasterCard gates in USAID is getting the millions that we were not getting.
This is a big new grant from the MasterCard Foundation to bring African students. And I know from experience of serving with Dave on the Compton fellowships that he always applied the utmost rigor, especially for methodology, and something that historians are not noted for.
Right.
And we always highly valued Dave's leadership in the center and on these committees. But another very important aspect of this engagement with Africa was the development, after you've laid this foundation that you've just been telling us about, of a whole raft of partnerships, partnerships and projects. And as I look through your CV, I was reminded of years of involvement, for instance, in the Great Lakes of Africa project and many others, the strong partnerships that were developed across the continent. Maybe you could just talk to how you developed this deeper partnerships with Africa. Obviously, we had this start with the University of Nigeria in Suka, helping to build that university on the land-grant model. But
when I was not here.
When you were not here. But when by the late 70s, early 80s, things were changing again in Africa. There was movement in Southern Africa, and we'll come back later and talk about the activist side. But what about this process of developing partnerships?
Well, I think, the key incident was President Nnamdi Azikiwe coming to President Hanna here with something like $50 million in his pocket from taxes he'd raised on palm oil in eastern Nigeria to build a people's university. So it was an African initiative. And we were invited as guests to join the Nigerians in the building of the university. And that was very, very different from our going as missionaries to do that. I think as well, frankly, the images of the missionary period and the missionary period from USAID and the World Bank as well all seem to be fraught with failure and tensions and with real problems. So it seemed like the model was, if you want to work in someone else's country, it just stands to sense that you ought to be good guests and you ought to be reciprocal, equitable, transparent in your dealings. And that when that happened, it was so unusual that the response in Africa again and again was very, very positive. So I think that we learned from that very early on. And then so we developed the part that is kind of the theme, as MSU as a partner rather than MSU as a source, as the fountain of knowledge. And I think, I don't know all the circumstances, but in our agriculturalists and our medical people took the same path. We did not go to do development projects in Africa to show them the way. We went to do training of PhDs so that they could make their own decisions. We went there to help in policy determination of what was needed in higher education, what was needed in the Ministry of Agriculture, what was needed in agricultural extension for the African governors of those societies to be successful. So I think it was a convergence of a lot of things. The most interesting development out of all of this was that as South Africa became independent during the Vice President Gore's time, U.S. formed a thing called the U.S.-South Africa Binational Commission, mm-hmm. and they had a thing on it called the Higher Education Forum, and I, as an Africanist, got to serve on that binational commission. We went to South Africa, met with the vice chancellors and presidents of the South African universities, and almost to a person, they were claiming, we are being inundated with American carpetbaggers who are coming here wanting especially to live in Cape Town and to, which they didn't know how nice other parts of South Africa actually were, and were wanting us to fund it. We're not clear about what they wanted or what they were going to do for us. They thought they had the answers for our problems and they could come and help us. And what can we do about this? And so we met both in Washington and in a suburb outside of Johannesburg. And came up with a set of principles of partnership, and those you can find on the center's website now, which simply outline how partners need to be equitable. They both need to know what they want out of a partnership. They both need to know what they can contribute. They both need to make material contributions, not just from grants. They need to be transparent in their budgets as well as in their programs, and they need to be reciprocal so that both sides are benefiting equitably. So I think that was a kind of breakthrough. Out of that, I got invited to a meeting of the Association of African Universities Vice Chancellors in Accra a few years ago, and a friend of mine, Vice Chancellor, introduced me, and he ended up by saying, well, we're really glad to have Dave Wiley come talk to us about these partnership principles, since we all know that Americans don't know how to do partnerships, which was tongue-in-cheek. But nevertheless, I think it reflects the problem of the quality of relationship between universities. So I think we've done pretty good. Frankly, we weren't perfect in our partnerships either. I see a lot of things that we could have done differently, but I think the principal was there, and we had a faculty that was very much open to that. And mm-hmm. The other nice thing about having a big African center here was we could go to the African countries and say, we want to come and join you in this project to do X, Y, or Z. We need you because we're trying to teach intelligently about Africa in our languages as well as in our social sciences, medicine, communications, education, arts and letters, and the like. And so we need your knowledge, we need your guidance, we need you to come and help us teach our students and so on. So there's a genuine need that it helped us to be equitable, mm-hmm. I think, in these ethics of partnership. So I think that's the story.
One of the largest partnerships after NSUCA was our partnership in the 1980s at University of Zimbabwe, which you were very much involved in. Well, is there anything that stands out there that?
Well, I think as one of the things that came out of it, John, was your leadership in building what I think was one of the best ever study abroad programs that we had with a full academic year at the University of Zimbabwe with no MSU faculty present. Mm-hmm. Had lots of its problems, and as one has with undergraduates and so on. And I never forget the Zimbabwean faculty in evaluating the program after 5 years telling us that they thought MSU students were great, lively in class, ask good questions, but why don't you teach them how to write before you send them out here, because they're not up to our secondary school standards of writing the literate 4-page essay. So at any rate, I think our agriculturalists did a wonderful job in building the first faculty of agriculture there. There was, like Ibadan in the 1960s, there wasn't a single agriculturalist on campus. Biggest department, and when we built NSUCA, by the way, in Nigeria, biggest department at the University of Ibadan was a department of classics, and where they'd learn Latin and Greek to read the originals from Aeschylus and Plato and the like. So I think that was something that was really needed to at there. And we had a lot of other faculty just jumped in, like Vince Haggerty, who went over and found the food safety, food science woman, who did not have a PhD, brought her here, found the funding to get her trained in food science, food safety, for to deal with all these street vendors of food and restaurants and all of these storage of food. So there's just a whole group of faculty and across a number of colleges that really liked the place, liked the people. And the Zimbabwean people are easy to like, easy to work with, being a segmentary lineage societies that are there.
And just across the Limpopo in South Africa, you mentioned it earlier, with the new South Africa, the end of apartheid, and you yourself had contributed to the movement to that, and we'll get to that in a minute, but you also land back in South Africa. You go to Durban, do some work in environmental issues, pollution.
Right.
How did it feel to be back in a free South Africa, having spent many years lobbying, supporting the African move, the majority move, and there you are back in Durban doing research and then finding the post-colonial problems again, as you found in Zambia?
Right. Well, it was striking. You know, actually, I'd never been in South Africa prior to independence, so I didn't have that until 92, actually, when John and Schneller and Betsy Eldridge, David Plank, and I all went to a conference at University of Durban-Westville as our first entry, being invited there by Professor J. Ram Reddy, the rector of University of Durban-Westville, the so-called Indian University. He had a great, by the way, affiliation with our president, John DiBiagio at that time. Both were dentists. And so they shared the discipline, which neither of their universities had expertise in. Any rate, so part of what is, you know, we felt that having been the only faculty that had voted to honor the United Nations boycott of South Africa, the cultural boycott, which says you don't go in as university to do research projects, you don't do partnership projects in apartheid South Africa, because you cannot help but end up living according to apartheid's rules and reinforcing it, as many of the American companies were doing there. So so we had never gone in. So when we had Reddy's invitation, it precipitated MSU thinking about how we're going to enter South Africa in this new period. And there was a decision to focus on the historically disadvantaged institutions, the HDIs, as they were called, and of which Durban-Westville was one before it is merged with University of Natal, the white university, to become the University of KwaZulu-Natal. And so we entered, starting with University of the North and its agricultural programs, with the University of the Transkei in a broad linkage, which brought a number of South Africans here for graduate study, including Nomblandla Jordan and Somadoda Fikeni and others who came in that partnership. But unfortunately, the South African government decided to favor the favored, and really said, we'll build research and excellence in Cape Town, Wits,
Durban,
University of Natal, Pretoria, and I'm missing one. At any rate, so I think that was our plan, to go in and work with the HDIs. So each of us tried to find a way to go there. I got a Fulbright to go to the University of Durban-Westville, work at the Institute of Social and Economic Research there, and got folded into an ICLE project, an international urban environment project to study the urban environment of Durban, where Chris, my wife, and I worked together on, she is affiliate as well, on waste management in Inanda, the biggest of the informal townships in what was then originally KwaZulu, and very much under Nkata domination, where we ended up trying to develop a waste management system to get the garbage out of that was piling out of tips or containers all through the township. We'd go out and get garbage at night, pour it out on the table and out of the plastic bags and see what was in it. Found out there was lots of soil and leaves and grass and so on, because people's kitchens are, which they sweep and put in the trash, are frequently outdoors behind the house. So we were negotiating with Durban Solid Waste to give them jobs and a lower cost on rates in exchange for eliminating that 60% of the waste that was compostables. And so that was one part of it. And then we linked up with wonderful colleague Bobby Peake, Seti Ramarath, Zesliwa and Keys, others, to do studies of South Durban and the industrial pollution down there and the protest against the people there. We were right there as the situation changed from the Reconstruction and Development RDP project to the GEAR project, the Growth project, which was really a sign that the corporations had convinced the ANC that they surely want jobs instead of clean air. And so still today, those folks in South Durban are suffering the increased cancer rates and asthma in children from the industrial pollution, which is in spite of a free South Africa. So we were very conscious of the heritage of apartheid everywhere. And I think that's true for both of you. I think that, you know, we saw, I saw, especially in trying to do joint writing projects with master's level students who still had been products of Bantu education and had never been expected to write, and were, and so they were intelligent and very articulate, very smart, and but had very, very low writing skills. And so that was one particular way in our research projects that we found it difficult. And then just the immiseration of the poorest of the poor. And I think the thing that struck me was that time when we saw the South African government spending billions on naval corvettes to protect the coastline at the same time that they were tossing African students out of the universities because their parents and they could not pay for the... South Africa, like much of Africa, is besieged by the super capitalism that does not believe in safety nets. And I think all over Africa and in South Africa as well, we see that as a very, very difficult, painful history.
It's a very sobering thought, and we can come back to contemporary issues in a minute. But to get to that stage of a free South Africa or other countries in the region, Angola, Namibia, required enormous efforts, suffering, sacrifices, and also a global anti-colonial, anti-apartheid movement. And you and Chris Root and others on campus here were very much involved in these social movements, anti-apartheid movements, bringing in the university disinvestment, bringing in the wider outreach, the community. Could you just speak to the paradigm of activism around Africa at MSU during your years, and how it, for instance, achieved some very tangible results with the freeing of South Africa? Mm-hmm.
Right. It's, frankly, it was easy. I mean, I wish that we had an issue that galvanized Americans today on policy toward Africa as much as it did then. Yeah, and I think, it was a mixture of coming out of the civil rights revolution in this country in the 60s, the largest and most destructive civil rights riot in the entire country in Detroit, right here on our doorsteps. The emergence of a call for rights for people of color was just so, that all of us, the both of you were deeply involved in this as well in your own history. So this is not new. And I had really gotten started in this on returning from Rhodesia as a frontier intern when at Princeton, Shamirira and several others of us at Princeton formed a thing called the Rhodesia Newsletter to try to get information out about the repression that we saw in Rhodesia and the American companies that were participating in it, even in southern Rhodesia, as the British termed it. This then, after about a year at Princeton, this morphs into the Southern Africa newsletter in with the University Christian Movement in to inform churches and government on Southern Africa issues in New York, and that then becomes the Southern Africa magazine. So I think that was really kind of the, we formed the New Jersey Committee on Southern Africa to boycott Engelhard and try to get Princeton to think about divesting. That went virtually nowhere over many, many years at Princeton, as it didn't in most elite universities, and so on. And so then in the University Christian Movement, we actually in 67, 68 formed a new committee on Southern Africa, and Wanda Lekuse, who was a South African, that was a Wisconsin teaching Xhosa at that, time, was with Dan Kunene, was a partner in that. And then, so I think, you know, it was growing everywhere. We weren't unique in that regard. I mean, and right now, you know, we, on the African Activist Archive, you can see more than 6,000 items up from these hundreds of groups across the country, in county and city governments and unions and churches and campuses especially, and so on. The at MSU, it was easy because Carol Thompson, Bill Derman, Lovemore Mgioni, and Bud Day had founded the Southern Africa Liberation Committee, which was in the process of working on the, I think, the first U.S. campaign for selective buying by the city of East Lansing to not buy products from companies that were also servicing South Africa, which was successful in 77. And then out of that then comes the movement towards MSU divestiture and the growth of the Southern Africa Liberation Committee, the focus on John McGough's name on the Wharton Center's Passant Theater, for which his family, McGough being an unregistered agent of the South African government, to win friends and newspapers for South Africa's apartheid policy in Washington and here in Michigan as well. And some of the whole series of campaigns there. So the question was, what would we do in the center? Well, I think we decided that there was an academic side to all this. So it got started when MSU was doing a study of divestiture, and the university administration said we need to know what the faculty think about this. So there was a committee, standing committee of the MSU faculty called the University Committee on Academic Environment, which looked at conditions that make for good learning and those which don't at MSU. And this committee said we need to study the situation, so the center gets called in to provide expertise on South Africa and the Southern Africa situation in general in that period in 77. It was at a time as well when I think all of us were being mobilized. We'd held a national conference on society, economy, and liberation in 77 here at MSU, which Emmanuel Wallerstein and Bill Mentor and Ivy Metsepe and lots of Ben Magabani and others from across the country came. And at that meeting, we decided the situation was so bad about U.S. Cold War involvements with Southern Africa and the rest of Africa that we needed to speak as scholars. And so decision was made here to form the Association of Concerned Africa Scholars and to... who issued a bulletin today, as a matter of fact, on African, African investments and still remain. So I think that was one side of it. The other side of it was that we got asked for opinion very frequently, and we decided in the end that there was an activist side of scholarship that was needed. And so we ended up sponsoring four national conferences on Southern Africa and U.S. response. One of these was focused on higher education. It was an interesting conference because we actually got foundation support from the Mott Foundation. And we brought representatives of the ANC. This was before South Africa's independence. ANC, SWAPO, MPLA, and others, plus about 300 U.S. academics to talk about what in higher education in the U.S. makes sense in an unfree South Africa. And frankly, the hidden reason for this conference was that many of the universities were saying, we aren't going to divest, we're not going to join sanctions, as MSU had, but we're going to do something positive. And doing something positive meant to bring South Africans from South Africa and giving them a BA education at our institution. So Harvard and Yale and others were bringing young South Africans. What we had noticed was those young South Africans were approved for exit and given passports by the South African apartheid government, while up in Salman Swangu Freedom College in Tanzania and scattered across Southern Africa were all sorts of young black South Africans who were excluded because we did not have a way to take refugee students. So that was one of the principles that emerged from this conference. American universities should take refugee students and not just those approved by the apartheid regime to come out. And I think that led to some change. And that meant that the MSU Nelson Mandela and other fellowships which were set aside for South Africans were focused on refugee scholars of South Africa and Namibia in that period. So that then led to other conferences after, we even had one after South Africa's independence in 1998, when once again this issue of partnerships came up, and Moses Turner on our education faculty helped us to organize a national conference that brought all sorts of prominent Ministry of Education officials and parliamentarians from South Africa with American academics to talk about what kind of partnerships make sense in this new South Africa. There are a bunch of ancillary projects which both of you have been involved in, the South Africa Film and Video Project, where we have contributed the equipment for the ANC to save some of its film and decaying video heritage in digitized copies. The Community Video Education Trust, which had 1960s UDF protest on film but never produced and deteriorating in order to save that. 1980, yeah. Sorry, thank you.
A wonderful project, and there was the African E-Journals project, there was Overcoming Apartheid, a wonderful teaching and learning project. Really, I mean, you were then moving into the digital world, doing joint projects, again, underpinned by this ethical approach to partnerships. And really, by the time I arrived in 2001, one of the attractions for me to come was this trailblazing that you were directing in putting a lot of stuff up on the internet, open access.
And the training of South Africans to do the same thing with their own materials, right?
I think this was important nationally. And at one stage you were leading the African Studies Association. Could you perhaps just speak a little bit towards your experiences in ASA and African Studies nationwide, Title VI, Area Studies Directors, all that sort of approach, and maybe as we segue into some concluding comments that how do you see the future of African Studies at MSU and nationally in the future? And maybe also we could... As we start to wrap it up, also talk about your current projects, which includes this really vital project on the militarization of Africa. So two questions there, really. One is the national approach to African studies, your role in it and where we're going, and dilemmas of Africa today with the military.
One of the things I was fortunate in is that my boss, Ralph Smuckler, the Dean of International Studies, really said it had its own agenda and encouraged us in the agenda to pay attention to the national health of African and international and language studies and not just our own. And a major portion of that was the outreach program of the center, which I want to say just a word about, because it's why we got John Metzler to come here to head this very, because outreach was seen in a land-grant university committed to extending knowledge to as a global mission, but also starting with Michigan and the United States. So that is why we had major projects over the years with support from the Department of Education, the National Endowment for Humanities, for taking Africa and African studies into four-year institutions. One big project focused on historically black colleges and universities in the South, as well as four-year colleges in the Great Lakes College Association. And then we added to that, which has been, I think, one of the unique focuses of the outreach program here, is the outreach to community colleges, which we were convinced that the majority of black Americans are in community, not four-year colleges, and so they deserve access to good African studies, and so that's been a big part of. So the founding of the 14,000 item African Media Program database of films and videos in Africa was all about providing teachers in these institutions and at the secondary level as well, with access to images of Africa, which were so needed given our inundation with the stereotypes of Africa. All right, so I think that these other digital projects then, the Overcoming Apartheid and the like, flow out of that feeling that we as a national resource center on Africa have a major mandate to pay attention to the national health of African studies. And we knew it was in our own interest because we're going to get good students. We've got to dissuade them of this negative imagery that our society was full of. So as to the African Studies Association, unfortunately I inherited my presidency there in a year when the association was in disarray with an executive director who was not functioning very well, and spent a great deal of my term in trying to bring the association back on track. Both Dave Robinson and I had served as chairs of the Committee on Current Issues, which was our sort of start in the association, where we did something that was regarded at that time as radical, that we brought representatives of liberation movements actually to speak in the African Studies Association, a scholarly association that should not be dirtying its hands with these activist, perhaps violent liberation people out there. So I think that's where we started with the ASA. But anyway, it's an important association. And I think this is the problem of Africa and African studies, to jump ahead a bit to your question, Peter, is that Africa does not have the cachet, the interest of elite populations that China, Brazil, India, even the Middle East have. And so even in places where Africa looms large, it is difficult to get university administrators and the public to give the attention, and the attention aside from the stereotypes to Africa that is given to other regions.
But that could change. Just last night I saw an intriguing commentary on Canadian foreign policy, a secret document that estimated that whilst today Africa has 8% of global trade, Africa and Asia and Latin America could leap to 80% by 2050. So I think people would be wise to heed what you're saying.
Heed, absolutely. Well, and with 40% of the world's natural resources, in especially key minerals, is just doubly important. But I think it's a problem, you know, like here at MSU, for instance, the MSU African Studies faculty, university-wide, has now for decades raised more funds for research and development work than all other world regions and the international studies together. I mean, it just keeps on keeping on, and now it's the ratio is even getting larger with these recent large grants. But somehow, I think when we go to it's the problem of African studies everywhere. When you go to the department and say we want someone on Africa, they say, well, I guess you need an anthropologist, don't you? Because they can teach us about the tribes and their funny languages. So I think that's the problem of African studies and so on. The ASA, I think, also has a problem in that, you know, it is largely an association of political scientists, historians, and anthropologists, with a sprinkling of economists, sociologists, psychologists even, and with the formation of their own organization, the art historians and the musicology people largely aren't there. So it has not succeeded in capturing that. And I think the other thing is that African studies is poor compared, if you see the huge grants that the Asia Society and those who are studying Asia have. It makes it difficult for people to get tickets to come to expensive conferences like our meeting in Philadelphia this year and so on. But anyway, I think ASA in the end of it has been important because ASA did join Michigan State, the Association of African Studies programs, the Title VI directors, in saying that we will together, in the context of this Cold War repression of Africa in support of dictators and CIA and DOD schemes against African governments, we will not join in accepting those funds. So I think it reflects that ASA, in the end, has a sensitivity to and commitment to Africa, that in a normative commitment that in some ways one doesn't see in a lot of other associations where everything is kind of a professional cast and as a career enlargement. So
One of the problems, of course, in going forward now and building even better partnerships is conflict, and we see conflict in the Sahara, in northern Mali, right. In eastern Congo, in North Africa. The militarization looms over Africa, and you have been one of those writing just this year in ASA's journal, African Studies Review, alerting scholars nationwide to these big dangers. Mm-hmm. Where do we go?
Well, where we go is to think about some of these long-term interests about African trade and African minerals and African peoples, and how much it is in our interest not to have this conflict. Now, the Milanovic's study in the World Bank, the best predictor of development in Africa is lack of civil conflict. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be deeply involved in bringing the resources to make the negotiations possible that lower the conflict, I think. But we're not putting the money into conflict reduction. There's small programs of the U.S. Institute for Peace, but in the end, not that much. And so it seems to me that what has happened is where in the homeland here, where the focus on military solutions and military industry as a source of jobs has grown and grown, that the focus is on military solutions. And I'm dismayed now to see that in a number of embassies in Africa, there are more military personnel than there are civil personnel. State Department Africa Hand told me that he estimates there were seven DOD people working on Africa policy to every one person working on Africa policy in the State Department. More lawyers in the Department of Defense than there are members of the State Department. More people in the military bands than in the State Department. We have chosen, through the largest military budget in the world, more than almost all other nations combined, to take the military path as a superpower. And largely because, as President Eisenhower noted, it's very much in the economic interest of many, many corporations who, for instance, this week will have something on order of 300 lobbyists in Washington making sure that the Defense Department procurement budgets do not get cut. So as it has happened at home, I think therefore our solutions in Africa sadly have been solutions that are not oriented towards negotiations. We had, in the case of the Islamic courts in Somalia, for instance, 90% of the Somalian people supporting them, even though they were pro-Sharia law. And we had a chance to negotiate that, but we didn't. We defined them as the enemy, and now they are Al-Shabaab, and we are, with the Ugandans and Kenyans, are at war in Somalia trying to eliminate them. And I think our wars, as they have been in the Middle East, will likely be no more successful in eliminating the problem, only creating blowback in the mobilization of new Al-Qaeda people now in the Islamic Maghreb and in Mali and so on. So I just have a feeling that our turn toward the military and intelligence solution, which never sort of ended after the Cold War years, has set us on a course which does not do well in Africa. So I'm trying to write something about that, including, you know, the problem that I see is that at independence, every African president inherited an empowered military because that had been the colonial government's first priority, was to build armies and police and prisons and courts and the like. And so the military has been empowered since independence in African countries, which takes away degrees of freedom from African presidents who can't not invest in them or for fear that they will turned towards pulling off a coup, as many of them have, and which leads to more resources going to the military in Africa than should be, than going to development projects of schools and clinics and bridges and roads and the like, which would facilitate it. So I think that we're on a bad course right now, and that's why I hope that the Africanists will keep their policy is until that course is corrected, to not be willing to be to participate in the in projects of our military and intelligence relating to African studies. So I think that's a big need that we have to have a turn away from the course we have chosen.
So much food for thought, and thank you, Professor David Wiley, one of MSU's most distinguished Africanists, for talking to us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to say my piece.